Birth, the Grand Division, Chapter 32. "Good morning, Boris," said Marina with her cold blue eyes. "Good morning, Marina. I have some good news," he said. "Your packages are on the way." "All four of them are on the water?" she asked. "The decoys were caught and made the evening news. The TV news anchors are calling it an attempted terror attack on Washington stopped by the ATF, and isn't it great that our Patriot Act saved us again? The White House has no comment. The online news outlets are saying it was all an inside job and that the press is lying," he said. "That was the easy part. Getting the whirlpools past customs here will be a challenge. We have to keep the container on the moor until it reaches Jeddah. Once it reaches Jeddah, we need to grease those crates to the royal suites," he said. "Grease the crates?" she asked. "We need to make sure that every person in the group has been bribed to keep them from opening the crates. Consider them grave robbers," he said. "Why do we have to do that?" she asked. "The Middle East works on bribes. It's part of their culture. Too large and they get lazy because they cannot think about anything further away than a week or so. Too small, and they will kill you or betray you because you disrespected them. If it is just the right amount of bribe, they will lie to God himself, so you will think of them first next time," he said. "It's the same in the old days." "So how will you know?" she asked. "If I teach that to you, I have no job," he said, smiling. "Who can you trust?" she asked. Boris said nothing. He looked her in the eye with all his skill and walked his bike back to the tool cage. He needed to begin designing and building the crates that would hold each whirlpool. They each made up royal cargo. It had to look like royal cargo, but so secure that no one without special tools could get into them. They needed to be anchored to the container floor lugs so that they did not slide around in the container. He installed two RFID tags, one that would be turned on with a cell phone once it arrived in Jeddah. The other might be disabled by someone planning to steal the container. After all, the payload was the most coveted in the world right now. Almaty, Kazakhstan, was located in the middle of an enormous landmass and surrounded by massive mountain ranges, making it extremely secure from any attack by ocean. There were 1,000 ways in and out by cargo plane, which made it unmatched for building things off the grid, so to speak. There were uranium mines just about everywhere that one could be engineered into the mountains. The population was so sparse that a flight plan could be designed that would make the plane invisible to ground detection. Getting the crates into the container for the moor would be easy enough using Hong Kong or Shenzhen as the departure city. All he had to do now was wait for the warheads to arrive, install the German triggers, and charge the bottles of tritium. Once the warheads were installed into the lead cases inside the whirlpools, they would be all but undetectable. Once they were delivered, the only thing to do was to pick the best time to detonate them. His heart was calm. It felt good to be in control again. "Hello, Boris," came the deep voice from behind him. He turned and was surprised to see the tattooed man standing there. "I'm sorry, I never got your name," said Boris. "Kolibnikov is my name," he said. "You're not former military," said Boris, knowing that anyone with facial tattoos would never be allowed to wear a uniform. "Military enough," he said. "How are you feeling today?" It was a strange question to ask. No one in the Soviet Union ever really cared how someone was feeling. "I am not unwell," he said. "I'm glad you came to us. We had an opening in logistics," said Kolibnikov. "You mean none of you wanted to be in a prison somewhere when the lights go out," said Boris. "Then you are feeling fine?" he asked. "My lights went out a few days ago. I just have some loose ends to care for," said Boris flatly. "Is there any way I can be of assistance?" he asked. "Make sure this equipment works right the first time," said Boris. "I can assure you," he said. "Like you have experience?" "You're a little young, comrade," said Boris. "And what is that accent I hear in your voice?" "My father was on board the USS Cole. I graduated from MIT in Boston, he said. American? Asked Boris. Yes, he said. So you have a bear in this fight, said Boris calmly. Dog. It's a dog in this fight. And yes, you might say that, he said. Well, we are in a small community, you and I, said Boris. Not as small as you might think, he said. Well, in a few days we will deliver 4 pieces of the finest sports equipment money can buy to the wealthiest men the world has ever known, said Boris, relaxing a little. May it make the last few minutes of their lives more glorious than ever, he said. Don't feed that hatred too much spicy meat, comrade. You might have them as neighbors in that heaven, said Boris, placing his hand on Kolibnikov's shoulder. Deep roots, my friend, he said. I love the people and fight their enemies. Hate no one, said Boris. That's good advice. Let me show you something, he said, opening the control panel to one of the 4 whirlpools. He opened the back panel, revealing the empty space where the warhead would bolt into place inside the lead box. This board, right here, has a SIM chip hidden underneath these 5-watt resistors. The resistors are wired to nothing, but the chip has a cell phone number, said Kolibnikov. So the devices can be detonated remotely, said Boris. Yes, he said. Clever, but old school, my friend. These triggers are easy to detect once the chip pulls the tower. The cell towers can be faked as well, said Boris. The Saudi royals know all these tricks. They'll catch it. We want to detonate them remotely, said Kolibnikov. If you try to call these devices simultaneously from outside the same cell, it will be virtually impossible to synchronize a detonation, said Boris. The switching. I see what you mean. What do you suggest? Asked Kolibnikov. SMS, he said. Text? Asked Kolibnikov. 1 text, 1 word, to all 4 numbers at once. Start a software timer in a synchronized string of code. They will detonate within a nanosecond of each other, said Boris. That sounds very possible, he said. 1 more thing, said Boris, waiting for the facial expression from the young engineer. The caller must be in the same microwave zone range as the whirlpools. No satellite bounce. Sounds like you're volunteering, said Kolibnikov. I love the most beautiful woman ever on this earth. I don't need the sun anymore, said Boris. You read about it from the New World. The young engineer put out his right hand and Boris gripped it. He handed Boris the black box. The cell numbers are on the card in this box. You can code the phones the way you like. I will tell Marina to make the arrangements, said Kolibnikov. Thank you, comrade. You have made my life complete, said Boris. Boris took the black box and released the young engineer's grip. He pulled up a stool to the workbench and opened a box and began to program his iPhone to make the connection. Kolibnikov walked up behind Marina and put his hands on her thin shoulders. Our friend is not a soldier. He's a hero, he said quietly. Heroes are usually the second to the last man standing, she said coldly. As smart as we think we are, he knows more. We're lucky to have him, he said. Did you promise him heaven? She asked, barely whispering through her perfect lips. Oh, that you loved me the way he loves her, he said. You know, it doesn't work that way, she said. What, my Marina? He asked, cupping her silky black hair behind the chair and letting it flow through his hands. We have a mission, my love, she said, slowly spinning her chair to face him with her deep blue eyes. I have no idea. I have no doubt he will complete it. He is not lying, he said. The opposite of truth may very well be another truth, she said. The result will be the same either way. What is one soul more or less? He asked, lowering his voice and staring back into her eyes fearlessly. One loving soul can change everything, she said, standing to kiss him softly on the lips and putting her hands on the back of his neck. Their faces were close now. He could feel the warmth of her lipstick on his lips, but he did not lick it away. Her feminine brutality left him without mercy, and yet he did not struggle in its jaws. Her heart did not break his skin, but its ability to crush him left no doubt between them. Few times in her life, had she smelled a man's fear this close. His tall and lean frame carried his trained power with grace, but it shivered like a dandelion seed stem before her gentle breath. She slid her cheek against his and neared his ear with her warm mouth. "I want to be with you forever," she whispered. "And I with you, my queen," he responded and placed his right hand on the small of her back. "The wick of his heart must be cut," she said. "The oil burns low in his lamp," he said. "See that it does," she said, pulling on his earlobe with her teeth. "I know what to do," he said. "That thou doest, do quickly," she said, facing him again, with her eyes bolting his heart to the altar between them. He smiled and slid his hand away from her back and turned to walk out the door. "I'll be back before you leave. You're my ride, my king," she said playfully. The young engineer heard the Jaguar click with electronic precision as his hand neared the driver's door handle. He slid into the leather seat, pressed the start button, and the turbocharged engine burst into life. The no-go zone in Almaty was only a few minutes away. Boris had that built-in courtesy left over from years as a Soviet bureaucrat, but he also had a good heart. He loved the Russian people, and it goes without saying that he loved his wife. But there was one person in this city bearing the scars of Boris's wrath. Still, it wasn't that Boris was nonviolent. It was the motivation behind the violence that made him a liability to the mission. Kolibnikov rolled down his window and began cruising through the streets of the Islamic section of the city. It had grown larger than he remembered it. The Sharia police were standing on nearly every corner, and they did not like to see the Jaguar or the white man driving it on their streets. Their black eyes of hatred locked onto him, but they knew better than to step off the curb toward him. The matching Jaguars were off-limits to jihadis in Almaty. He motioned to a group of three men standing by the deli that had been taken over in recent years. They walked tightly together toward the Jaguar. "There is nothing for sale to you," said the shorter of the three men. "I am looking for a man with scars on his face," said Kolibnikov in a deep voice. "The one from the news?" he asked. "Bring him to me now," commanded Kolibnikov in a staccato tone. "Habibi, who do I say is asking?" asked the short man. "I have a gift for him," said Kolibnikov, "but only if he comes in the next 10 minutes. I am lighting my cigarette." The shorter man shot a quick phrase to the other two men with him and slapped them on their chests. They both took off running in different directions. "Smoke slowly, Russian." Within a few minutes, a Toyota four-door pickup pulled up into the parking lot next to the Jaguar, and four men got out. They stood in front of the car and looked through the windshield at him. He glanced down at his rearview mirror on the door and saw the other man approaching from the rear. His face was disfigured. "What do you want?" asked the jihadi, with cuts still healing on his face and neck. "I have a gift for you," said Kolibnikov. "I do not accept gifts from scum like you," he said with grit on his voice. "This is a gift of revenge, and you will accept it, Daesh. It comes from a very high place of power," said Kolibnikov. "Speak, infidel," he said. "Boris Domashov. You know him, yes?" he asked. The man put his left hand on his cheek and felt the swollen lines on his face. "He will be alone on October 1st in Mecca," he said. "That is the time of the Hajj, "Why does this infidel go there at this time?" asked the scarred man. "He is delivering something for me. It is his specialty," said Kolibnikov. "Yes, I know, the FedEx man. I will kill him, you know," he said. "I know you will try." "You can help me keep my books clean and collect your debt," he said coldly. "Do you need money?" "For this journey, I have sufficient for my needs," said the man. "Well, you have a little more than 3 weeks to make your arrangements," he said. "How will I find him?" asked the scarred man. "I will provide you his cell phone GPS location," said Kolibnikov. "I will be back in 2 weeks to check with you." "Until then, God willing," he said. "Oh, he wills, believe me," said Kolibnikov. He rolled up the window and drove back to the shop.